Sometimes you have it like
November 18th, ICANN 48, La Pampa, 2 p.m.
start recording right now?
Yes.
Okay.
So, good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session. Of course, as usual, the participation is postprandially much less than before. But usually, traditionally, one punishes the ones that come for the ones that don't come. Next presenter is Anne-Marie Eklund-Löwinder, complicated name, from .se. She will talk about information security management and certification. I like this idea about certification like ISO 9000 or whatever it's called, and this one. Haven't got much insight into this myself, but I find even if you don't certify, the principles that use that you have reproducible processes that, you know, if something happens, you have a process, you know how it works, you can figure out what happened and why and so on. It's quite a good thing. And the bigger CCDLDs, like Sweden, with how many domain names?
More than a million? About 1.3 million.
1.3 million. They need this also probably because of regulatory requirements. So without further ado.
No, actually not. We are doing it because we are so good. So, good afternoon. Welcome back from lunch. I'm Anne-Marie Eklund-Löwinder, and it is a complicated name. I work as the security manager at .se, the Swedish registry, and I will very, very briefly take you through what we are doing, and I will talk a bit about risk and information security management in a CCTLD and explain a bit about 27001, what, how, and why you should do it. This will be kind of a crash course, but I don't expect you to be able to read everything I have on my slides, but I put them up because I would like to give you the opportunity to get back to them later and say, what was she talking about anyway? So we are a foundation and a non-profit organization running not only .se, but we also run .nu. This is a little bit about us in figures from last year, and I used to bring this up when I want to remember what are our responsibilities, and that is from the RFC 1591. We are the trustees for the delegated domain and have the duty to serve the community, and trust, as you all know, is something that you have to deserve. It's nothing that you just gain or get from anyone. So how do you do that? Well, one way doing it is try to work in a good way, efficient and safe and secure. And information security as an everyday work, that is a matter of skills and knowledge. It's not about luck. I mean, we can be lucky sometimes to get out of problems, but still you need to do this very properly to gain availability, information integrity, confidentiality, and not to mention traceability. So the tasks of a TLD registry, this was put together by Wim de Gezelle from the Center Secretariat for another occasion, but I thought it was kind of a good way to look at what a TLD registry is doing from a day-to-day work. And the domain name resolution service, we have the registration service, we have directory service providing host information, and we have traditional business service as anyone else, like billing, customer support, and sometimes dispute resolution. And the TLD part, the domain name resolution part, that is the key function, and that is something that we are really good at. We are doing it extremely well. We have been working with it for a long, long time, and we know exactly what works and what doesn't work, and we are very accurate when it comes to infrastructure and building that in a good way. So the other ones, I mean the regular business class security needs. The only one that we have that deserve real special attention and that we give real special attention, that is the domain resolution service. But we shouldn't forget about the other parts, the regular business class security needs, because they are important too. They are important to be able to show publicly that you are taking care of the customers in a good way. And Bruce Schneier used to say that the internet is too complex to secure. One of the reasons is that it's too complex to understand. And that is also true if you consider taking it into one chunk. But don't do that. I mean, if you just take things apart and you take them one by one, step by step, I think you are on top of things. The methodology I use to work with is know your business needs. I mean, if I don't know what my business need, I don't know what to do. And then you have to identify assets and threats, secure and harden, monitor and detect, respond if that is required, and learn and improve. That is, you know, the old PDCA process. And then you start all over again. This is from a site from a book, Signposting Cyberspace. The reason I took this in is I will once again point out that operators of the DNS are responding to all the threats they see, but the rest of the organization, the rest of the business, also have their threats, and we tend to forget that part sometimes. So while the ccTLD are a relatively small infrastructure provider, but it's used by most internet users. So that is our responsibility, to make sure that it is usable all the time. And current practice on high-level security resilience are in place to ensure the DNS part of the function that we have. And we all have all these good active platforms to exchange experiences and knowledge, which is good. But we also have human resources. We have information to take care of, other kind of information than DNS. We have hardware and software. And we have premises that we have to protect. And all these are part of an information security management system to be able to go through all the different details. Sometimes when I start working with this, it's a long time ago, I decided to go with ISO 27000, not to certify in the first place, but to have, our chair here mentioned, to have this framework to work with, to make sure that I don't forget anything. Because, you know, I'm not alone, I tend to prefer working with things that I appreciate more or that are more fun, and I tend to put on hold those things that are not so funny. So to avoid that, a framework that takes in all the parts is very good, actually. So why should an organization go through an ISO 27000 certification? Yeah, firstly, as I mentioned, it's about trust. It's a way to prove and show others that you are taking information security seriously. And it also makes you work with a continuous information security improvement cycle, which, as I said, makes sure that you don't forget or skip something that is not as fun as DNS, for instance. And the working processes are very structured. And it also builds up your image as a serious TLD. And there are two parts of the standard. It's 27001, which is about what you should do, and 27002, how you can implement the controls. So there are two different parts that match each other. Before you start, I recommend that you get full support from the CAO and the management team, because if you don't have them behind you, it's very, very hard work to make this happen and come through. And you should have a good reason for certification, and a good reason is we feel responsible for our customers and their domains. And work together with your colleagues. You can't do this alone. You can't stay in your room, try to work out this information security management system on paper and just believe that it will happen. It's not how it works. And build your own. Don't take anyone else's, because if you build it suitable for you, means a small organization needs a small ISMS. Very easy. And keep it simple. Do not complicate things. You don't need that. Be very practical. And choose the right auditor. Make sure that you have an auditor that not like to punish people, but to help you to come through this process. They can be very, very supportive, but they can also be very auditish. Another thing, things you shouldn't do is, again, don't do it on your own. And don't lose yourself in the risk analysis swamp. That is easily done, because risk analysis is something that the management team mostly have heard about. And it's easy to get caught in that. You do the risk analysis, but you don't even follow up later, and you don't have the mitigatings that you need to either eliminate risks or just manage them in any way. And don't have too many KPIs, key performance indicators, because it's too hard to measure and follow up. Choose a small number and change them from time to time, just to make sure that you know where you're standing. So the fundamentals of the standard is that it is a model for establishing, implementing, operating, monitoring, reviewing, maintaining, and improve an information security management system. It is indeed a strategic decision to get on this track. And it should be scaled in accordance with the organizational needs, as I said. And the requirements are separated in 8 different chapters, and there are some annexes to it too. So I will not go through that, I promise. And here's a sort of PDCA cycle for the ISO 27001 implementation. So, I mean, you can use this wheel for a number of things. But when you're planning, you establish the management system, you have the risk analysis, you define the scope, which is very important. You have to restrict the scope of the certification. Define gap and risk mitigating control objectives. So next step would be do, and that is when you implement the system or the management system. And here something happened in Adobe, I think, so because it has cut off the text on the check and act. I have to mend that later. I'm sorry for that. There are some very strong documentation requirements. And the documents must be not only written, but identified, reviewed, approved. You should have versions, revisions, and you should make sure that you have distribution that is correct and updated, that people are knowing that you have an information security management system, that they are aware of the content of the system. And you should have control of records. So the most important documents that you put up is the scope, as I told you, the statement of applicability, which is also known as SOA. I know that DNS family will get confused when you start to talk about SOA. But this is another SOA. And you should have all the related documents in a good order. This is our scope. This is what we put up as the scope for our ISMS and the certification. And that is the administration and technical operation of the National Domain Name Registry for the Swedish top-level domain.se. So we haven't certified the entire organization. We picked the part that we think is most important in regards to our customers. We have a lot of other things that we are doing, like running projects, we have conferences, we have education, but that is not a part of the certification yet. It will become that, because I found out that it was much harder to restrict the scope than to take in the entire organization. And management is responsible for a number of things, and this is I believe, the most important commitments. You have to have at least 4 meetings a year about this. They should be minutes from them. Everything has to be traceable. So the auditor can come to you and say, can you show me the minutes or the protocols from the meetings that the management team have had about this? Resource management, provision of resources, training, awareness, and skills. So you have to have education of staff. You can choose any way you like to do it, but you have to do it. And you have to be able to prove that you've done it. So if you have an educational program, you have points, what you've gone through, or you have any tests, whatever, just show that you have done it. I can do internal audits myself, and I do that regularly. They should be in planned intervals too, and the goal is to determine whether controls are effective, if they are maintained, and so on. And we have an auditing process that we are following. Yeah, I think I'm running out of time. This is a bit of a small detail from Chapter 6 about the internal audits. The management review, that should take place at least once a year, where you go through everything you have, like the feedback you got from earlier, the audit, the vulnerabilities that you have seen lately, changes. And the output from that is, again, minutes and documentation. Documentation is a big part of this, of course. So continuous improvements, you have to audit and improve the system itself. The certification is valid for 3 years, but you need to do an annual update to make sure and be able to keep the certificate, which looks like this in our case. And then you can brag about it on your website. You can put this logo on and, you know, let people know that you are working hard with information security. So that is very, very, very briefly about 27001. And my recommendation is start working on it. The goal itself is not, I repeat, it's not to get certified. The goal is to have an information security management system that works for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As I said, for small organizations, I don't know whether there is a cost involved in getting certified, whether who is the actual authority signing this. But we discussed it, I think, already in Mexico on the Tech Day. We had a presentation by a risk management company. What in more detail needs to be done to sort of anticipate and mitigate risks, hot standby, warm standby, cold standby, this kind of things. It's not so much that you have a certificate, but that you have got a process in place where you start thinking about what you're doing, how it can affect your operation if there is a failure, and how you plan about it. Any questions? I know that the Czech registry has, .cz has done this. There's another registry that has done it. Denmark, DK has done it, and NL have done it. What's your experiences, and EU? What's your experiences? Have you got any contribution?
I mean, the cost is, it's a fixed fee, actually. I think it's restricted. ISO have stipulated that there is a fee connected to the certification, but it's fixed, so it's not that expensive. We do more things that are more expensive than that. So,
all right. Thank you very much. When we planned this, we decided to give Anne-Marie a break, and because she has got 2 presentations, I don't really like people to speak 2 presentations in a row. It's also a bit of a strain on the voice. Therefore, the IATF is going to give us a short update on what they want to say. Yari, there it is. that the one?
That's the one.
You want to sit or you want to stand?
Do we have a mic for
stand? Yes.
Great.
Have a seat. Have a seat.
So my name is Jari Arko. I'm from the ITF and the chair, and I prepared a small update on what's been going on at the ITF in the last meeting together with Russ Housley, chair of the IAB. And this is, you know, maybe not exactly on topic on the kinds of things that you normally deal with in the country code world, but I think very interesting nonetheless. So what I'm going to do is go over some high-level topics that have been hot topics a week ago in our meeting in Vancouver, and then talk about one of those topics in more detail, which is the pervasive monitoring surveillance issue. And this week, you've probably already seen and will see some sessions where people talk about internet governance and how, you know, the Snowden revelations affect that. This is not about that. This is about, you know, the technical aspects of that, and is there something that us engineers can do about it? Okay, so the topics that, at least from my perspective, were the highly interesting ones in addition to pervasive monitoring was HTTP 2.0, which is a relatively big redesign of the protocol we all know and love. And more efficient, you know, hopefully more secure. TLS 1.3, also a similar redesign, big change again. It's going to be more efficient. We're trying to cut down on the setup time, for instance, and it's going to be more secure. You remove the weaker algorithms, adopt some new procedures that protect the identities better, and so forth. We also talked about WebRTC quite a lot. During the ITF week, so WebRTC is this technology where you can have, you know, instead of having an application for your voice over IP thing, you can do this in the browser and without any plugins. And we also talked about the evolution of transport protocols, looking at things like, you know, TCP and TLS and HTTP together. Can we optimize that even further beyond the things that are done by HTTP 2.0 and TLS 1.3? So, I mean, in many cases, what we do at the ITF is kind of, you know, we tweak the details and you know, worry about, you know, bit fields here and there. But I at least felt that during the last meeting, we were really, really dealing with, you know, a number of pretty fundamental issues that will have a long-lasting effect on the internet. Like, you know, we're going to have to live with the HTTP, or the new version of HTTP, for a long time, and hopefully out of the pervasive monitoring discussion we'll get some new security features into the internet protocol stacks. So I think it was a very, very good week and interesting discussions, and heated discussions at times, of course, but that's only good. We need to get the issues out. But on to the pervasive monitoring topic. I just wanted to set the stage a little bit first. Like, you know, what is this? You know, is ITF now a forum for political discussion? We're not. We don't really. I mean, some of us might have opinions about things, but the ITF is not the forum to voice those political opinions or you know, opinions about what is being done or not being done and so forth. And I'd also like to remind people that, you know, if you read the newspapers, you see a particular picture. If you actually perceive the world, and, you know, many of us are involved in networking around the world, you should realize that it's actually a wider problem around the world than it's what it's being perceived in the newspapers. But that being said, so we at the ITF should understand what dangers internal face internet traffic, and if there's something that we can do or should do about improving the internet security and internet technology in general, then we should really go about that. So that's a general scope. And we've had a discussion in Vancouver as well as on List before and in various other discussions about, you know, how should we perceive the surveillance or pervasive monitoring. And the general consensus has been and is that this should be considered as an attack from the perspective of the internet protocols, or at least it is something that is indistinguishable from attacks. So we don't really know what the information is used for. It could be used for good or bad. Consider thieves stealing passwords. And then there's this consideration that you know, vulnerabilities or security problems tend to democratize over time. So if today an intelligence agency can do this, then maybe tomorrow a criminal group can do it, and the day after tomorrow, you know, your neighborhood kids can do it. So if there's a vulnerability, we actually need to deal with that in some manner. So we do consider that as an attack. And just, you know, a little bit of technical information. Obviously, we don't have information about exactly what's being going on with the NSA. And in some sense, it doesn't even matter necessarily so much because it's just one example. But the likely attacks that are, you know, possible, you know, first of all, obviously, if you have unprotected communications, you may be vulnerable to people listening in. Well, yeah, the internet is largely about unprotected communications today, so maybe there's a lesson there. Direct access to the peer, so if you're talking, even if you have perfect communication security, you're talking to someone, if they leak your conversation, then that might be an issue. Direct access to keys, this might have been the case with LavaBit, it was going on in the US a while ago. Third parties could be used to make an attack, for instance, fake certificates and routing information, and then, you know, sort of inserting yourself as the man in the middle without anyone knowing. Implementation backdoors, and this is really huge, actually, too. So, you know, different pieces of software or even hardware might have backdoors or vulnerabilities that the rest of us don't really know about it. You know, one example is random number generators. If they're not as random as they're supposed to be, then the search space for cracking something is smaller. Or we could have vulnerable standards. You know, one example of that is the one on the screen from NIST, which they basically publicly confessed that this is not necessarily safe anymore. So different types of vulnerabilities in attacks, and you can sort of see, you know, how to deal with some of this, and it's kind of obvious, but it's an important observation is that it's, you know, some of this is maybe standards related, some of this is implementation related, and so on. So vulnerable standards, I mentioned the random number generator example already. There's another one which is pretty important given the widespread use, RC4 algorithm when used in TLS. You know, we don't have as warm and fuzzy feeling about that as we used to, perhaps. So that may need to go. There's also been some discussion about on-purpose planted weaknesses in various standards, including ITF standards. I think one case was made about IPsec. No one really knows whether those should be taken seriously or not. But, you know, my personal perception, having been involved in some of those discussions at the time that some of these standards were made, and discussing with other people who had been there, even more closely following the situation, is that may not be. I don't personally think that's very likely. I think there's issues with algorithms, and this is not to say that ITF standards don't have security problems. They do, and they have plenty of other issues too. Just that this was a case of whether some maliciously planted direction in the standards has caused us problems. So anyway, with all this background, what can the engineers do? So first of all, it's important to understand that technology alone will not be the sole solution, because it only goes so far. I can encrypt I can protect my communications with someone. I can have perfect communication security. But again, if I don't trust the other party, I'm in trouble. But we can prevent some attacks. We can also increase the cost of attacks or surveillance, in terms of money that has to be spent, or in terms of there'd be more risk to getting caught. We can shift attacks from sort of wholesale attack on everyone, you know, just in case, to more targeted attacks. We can move from passive to active attacks and so forth. And sort of the other point is that given that there's so much attention on this matter, this is an opportunity to. I mean, it's required for us to look at the situation, obviously, and make whatever we can do about it. But at the same time, it's also an opportunity that now that there is so much attention on internet security around the world, so if we actually want to push some new security solution, this is the time. And it's not always easy to do this at any given time. So this is maybe the one chance that we have, I don't know, this decade or something. So it's kind of important opportunity. We should use that wisely. So some directions for protection. Obviously, if you have unprotected communications, you should consider protecting them. If you have vulnerable standards, you're laughing, but it you know, most of the internet is unprotected communications. So, and vulnerable standards. What we can do about that? We can do more public review, and this is like what the ITF is about. We have broad base for reviews and lots of people reviewing documents and proposals. We can decommission old algorithms. We can design new solutions. We can look at the implementation backdoors, and that's not a standardization issue, by the way. But there's ways of going around that. If we have more diversity in the set of implementations on a particular piece of app or particular type of application, then that's good. If we have open source, that's good. We can do other kinds of review, even if it's not open source. That's good. Some of us were involved in a proposal to develop a piece of open source hardware that would be a little bit better verifiable, that you can actually trust better to do important security tasks. And so there's many kinds of things that can be done. So what is the ITF doing around these kinds of efforts? So first of all, we kind of felt that it's important to discuss the topic. This is not something, I mean, it's just sweep under the rug. We need to discuss it openly. We have the purpose list, which is one of the primary lists dedicated for this topic. Russ was running the technical plenary at the IETF, which talked about only this topic with Bruce Schneider and Stephen Farrell and Brian Carpenter, and talking about the topic. The IAB is going to organize a workshop before the next IETF meeting in London. The Friday before, yes, Russ? Yeah. On this topic, we'll be issuing a call for papers soon on that. And, of course, for me at least, the primary thing is that the actual working groups who do most of the work, the ITF, are actively engaged in this topic and trying to understand what can they do and make improvements or do more analysis. And we, of course, are working on the problem in general sense, trying to understand the threat model and what classes of solutions exist. We have some specific proposals on what to do with TLS and its algorithms. PFS, perfect forward secrecy feature in TLS, is important to be turned on, as an example. We have ongoing efforts that were started before all this came out that actually have an impact on this matter as well, HTTP 2.0, TLS 1.3. And the sort of the important thing is also that the IETF is a place to bring together the different stakeholders to discuss the different solutions. So when you're doing something, let's say improve the security of the web, it's not just the browser or the server and both of them. It's also proxies in all kinds of security solutions that we have to worry about. So we kind of feel that this is an opportunity for us to discuss this in a broader setting. And some of the highest interest efforts, for me at least, have been, first of all, outside the ITF. You can just turn on more security, whether it's TLS or some other mechanism. But TLS, in particular, has been very popular in many types of services. And already before everything came out, this trend will now accelerate. So you've seen like Facebook and Google, to some extent at least, moving to secured connections or HTTPS, so that is something that will probably accelerate with other services as well. Then we're going to do algorithm cleanup on TLS and IPsec and many other things. And that's an implementation thing and specification thing, so there's both work for the implementers as well as the IETF. Then we're having a huge discussion about what to do with security for the web, for HTTP 2.0. The current standing proposal is that HTTP 2.0 is only for HTTPS URLs. This basically means that you want to do more HTTP 2.0, then you're going to move more of your more of your web presence to the secured links. And it's a huge discussion. It's ongoing. It has been going since mid last week in particular. If you're interested in that topic, please join the mailing list. And also, I mean, that this wasn't such a high profile thing in doing the IETF meeting. I just wanted to bring it up here, given the ICANN context. Some people have been asking about DNS. You know, what should we do about DNS? Does DNS require, I mean, should we have confidentiality for DNS queries? That's basically the question. So that's what I was going to say. I have some further reading and pointers that you might want to look at. The only thing that I want to mention in particular is this recording of the plenary session that Russ was running, the technical plenary with Bruce Nyer and others. I think that's a really, really interesting material. If you watch one internet security-related video this year, maybe this should be that video. So that's it. And Russ, do you have...
Two things. So I would like to point out two statements that the IAB made in recent weeks that are related to all of this. They're both available on www.iab.org. The first one is a joint statement that the IAB made with the Internet Society, the W3C, and the IEEE. And we pointed out that with these accusations that the standards process might have been tampered with by intelligence agencies, that the only defense to that is broad review during the development of those standards. So get involved, review the work, and because that's your only defense against that kind of an attack. The second thing is that we wrote a letter to NIST. They apparently have this one standard that was messed with in some surprising way. And they asked what should be done about it. So the IAB sent them a very specific and detailed list of things they ought to do about it, and basically suggested a much more open and transparent process where all comments from all reviewers and how they are handled is put online for every standard they develop in the crypto space and the cybersecurity space going forward. Anyway, I think that basically we're saying follow the example that has been used in the internet community for a long, long time.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if we have any time for questions. I mean, the basic message is that, you know, we're looking at this problem from a technical perspective, and the community is hugely engaged in this topic and are actively working to improve security of the internet in general, not just because of this particular revelation. So, you know, we'd be very happy to get even more people involved. So please join the mailing list and engage in the discussion.
Okay, thank you very much. It was a very nice presentation. It's also the first time that we had the adults talking to us. And I think we should continue this. We all know how IETF works. Everybody can go there, and it's a meritocracy. So if you are clueless, they will figure it out. And if you have input to make, they will figure this out too. And so everybody who has input to make, just join the mailing list. And I think most of the work is done on the mailing list. So if you don't go to the meetings, I follow one or two of these things. It's well over my head, but it's always very interesting to read the stuff. Any questions? Oh, they're all overwhelmed. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And I hope we'll do this in the future again. Okay, Anna Marie will do her second presentation now. before she starts, I don't know, I didn't read the presentation, but I remember, or maybe some of you remember, in Tech Day in Cairo and in Brussels, we had Patrick Mefcek speaking, who wrote a Perl library, DRI library, where you can write very easily tools to access your APP server. That's what I use, for example, to see if our server is alive and things like this. And sometimes I hear complaints, EPP is not working. I run that thing and it works very nicely. But it's always good to see different things in the wild.
Okay, thank you. I feel like I'm a part of a Monty Python. Now over to something completely different from the last presentation. And it's not only because I like to hear my own voice. I'm the only one brave enough to want to talk about this. So the background is EPP has a number of years. Created 2000, draft RFC 2004, 2007 it was ready, and then we implemented it internally while we were putting our new production system into work. And by 2009, when we changed our business model, we forced all the registrars to use EPP only and nothing else. No emails, no website, no nothing. Only EPP. And 2012, while we got a contract with ICANN for pre-delegation testing, we got a lot of experience from EPP implementations. And we realized there were no publicly available test tool to help support industry to make sure that you have it running smoothly. So the overview, it uses the same XML input file as the PDT does, the pre-delegation testing system, that is. It tests all different parameters, like connectivity, IPv4, IPv6, domain transactions, create, update, delete, transfer, contact information, hosts, and it can actually be expanded to do more good stuff and can handle any extension schema. So this is how it works. It converts a PDT EPP XML file into an intermediate internal config file, and the test performs through communication with an EPP server and writes to a log file, and that is where we get the report from the outcome. It's open source. We realize that people will need to use this and implement it themselves. So it's on GitHub, and here's where we have our account, the name of the tool. It's not a one-to-one equal part that the EPP self-test tool and the actual EPP testing under PDT is not equal. So running the EPP self-test tool successfully doesn't mean that you will pass the PDT test. So I just have to make sure that you understand it's not the same. And if you want to learn more of this, there's a readme file on GitHub, and you may also address questions about the tool to my colleague, Jan Sell, who is the developer behind it. And there are a number of other useful tools from us. IDN properties is another useful tool for those who are running TLDs that have IDNs. We have our DNS check, which I frequently use to do a health check of .se every year. And that is a checking tool for checking DNS delegation quality. And we also have a small tool called PacketQ, which is very nice to get deeper into PCAP files to get the details out from it. And there are others who are making very, very good tools like NLNet Labs, the CreeDNS, and ValidNS is also another tool that is very useful. So that would be all, and I hope you find it useful. And if you have any suggestions or questions, don't hesitate to email either me or my colleague Jan Sell. He would be delighted. And questions will be answered on best effort, because I don't know anything about EPP.
OK, Okay, I have a question. Have you run this already against Fred or against CocaTools?
I don't know.
Okay.
That is one of the questions you could put to Jan, maybe. Or do you know, Torbjörn? No.
That was a short answer. Okay, that's something that I'm at least going to play with because it would be interesting. Why don't you, I'm wondering, why wouldn't you try to make this test tool sort of conform to PDT testing so that people can use that sort of to get it ready, test it, it works, then they can go to pre-delegation testing.
Yeah, but still, the pre-delegation testing is something different from just having a self-test tool of your EPP implementation. So, and I think that the self-test tool have been further developed than the version that we are using in the environment that we put up for PDT. I think that is the easy explanation to it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I must just look who is the next one because I forgot. Okay, the next one is Norm Ritchie. He will speak about the Secure Domain Foundation.
Where is your presentation? Ritchie, there you go.
Hello. Hi, I'm Norm Ritchie. Today I'm here on behalf of the Secure Domain Foundation. I want to give everyone here an update for those of you that are aware of it and for those of you who are not aware of the SDF. Hopefully it'll be very informative. So a bit of background on this. The FDF really came a concept we started back in, it was ICANN Costa Rica. So some of you that were lucky enough to be there, Chris Davis, my partner in crime in this, made a concept. And his observation, Chris is a well-known in cybersecurity circles, that recidivism is rampant in the domain industry. So when the bad guys, they all use domains now. So when they're caught doing something, domains taken down, they just merely go get another domain and carry on. So the damage to them is $6, which is nothing. And you know, that's very frustrating because there's actually a lot of work to do the research, the analysis on the malicious domains in the first place and build a case, only to have them quickly just move somewhere else. So the concept that was put forward is, you know, very simple. So, you know, if we work together as registries and registrars and hosting companies, share information about the bad guys, and we can actually prevent them from doing that. Very, very simple concept. So the feedback from it, for the most part, has been pretty positive. Everyone said, yes, great idea. Why don't you guys go and do something about it? So for the last year and a half, Chris and I have continued to work on this. So we actually started off with basically a daily feed of malicious domains that we identify. We analyze through emerging threats about anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000 malware samples a day. And from those, we extract the domains, and we have some indication of what that badness is about the domain, whether it's command and control or you know, someone that was seen in a website buying, you know, credit card numbers or, you know, whatever that may be. There's about 9 categories. So that daily feed evolved to an API, and then that API has evolved a bit further. It's actually evolved to more of a reputation system now. So basically from an email address, you can get a score on the reputation of that email address. Is it good or bad? Allowing a bit more proactive any abuse measures to take place. You have some indication before you actually register a domain or, you know, set up an account if you're hosting or whatever, that has someone else seen that domain, and what badness do they see about it. The SDF is incorporated. It's a Canadian nonprofit. Yay. Chris and I are both Canadians. Chris is online, by the way. If anyone's seen him online, he's there somewhere. And we're going to officially launch this in January of this year coming. The handsome guy on the left is me. And the other guy is Chris. The reason I want to show you this, though, is that I come from the domain industry. I've been doing this for, you know, God, seems like forever now, probably 15 years. Chris is the same. He's been doing cybersecurity since the early 90s. And Chris and I happen to be friends. We work together on a number of initiatives in Canada. But what we found that I know the domain industry, but not so much about cybersecurity. Chris knows a lot about cybersecurity and a bit less about the domain industry. But we both realize that the two of them are so tightly intertwined, that's important that we work together. And through the last 18 months, it hasn't just been Chris and I doing everything. We've had some other people that have stepped forward and have been assisting us to develop the SDF and the database and the API. I'll get into that in a second, what that is. You know, I'd like to recognize them. Facebook has been awesome. They provide us a daily feed of bad domains that they uncover. They're very, very supportive. Internet Identity, the Anti-Phishing Working Group, also quite supportive in supplying information. Demand Media, who many of you know as Enom, has also been a great partner as well. We are actually currently doing a baseline analysis of their entire suite of domains, with 18 million of them. Nominet, I think Roy's here somewhere. Roy's always great in this. Emerging Threats, Trend Micro, Gonzalez, who's up later on today. Soka, and of course, CrowdStrike. Chris and I both work for CrowdStrike now. They're very, very supportive of the SDF, and they support us in doing it. There are others. Bank of America has just expressed interest in this and asking how they can help. ESET, if I've said that right, the antivirus company, they're also stepping forward. Tomorrow we're talking to a large hosting provider. So what do these people do? Well, they give us bad guy email addresses. That goes into a database, and I'll get into the size of the database here in a second. When there's a terms of service breached, quite often we can, depending on the contractual agreements, we may be able to get additional information about what was behind that account that is not normally available. So that might be what is behind the privacy for a domain registration, or you know, what is a browser, the fingerprint that that bad person was using. The malware data analysis, of course, excuse me. People may help on investigations, whether that's research or analysis. There may be some type of development that needs to be done. We can't do it all. Or also just on the operational side of running the service. So the current evolution. We have MD5s, which is how you identify the malware, mapped to the domain name and categorized. There's over 86 million records on this in the database. On the email addresses, we have over 7 million of those. We have a very, very comprehensive set of Whois data, over 26 million records there. We think we have actually one of the most comprehensive Whois databases right now. We have browser fingerprints. It turns out that browser fingerprints, if you're not aware of that, it's a way of looking at querying the browser and asking it to respond on its configuration, such as, you know, what font packs are installed, in what order, et cetera, and you know, what plugins may be there. But it turns out there's a great deal of information sent back, and it's also sent back in a specific order. And that actually gives you a very unique, not totally unique, but with 99% uniqueness on that browser fingerprint. Again, yeah, I already talked about the terms of service violation logs. For those of you that do cybersecurity, you might be familiar with Multigo. It's a visualization tool for connecting different things. It's used quite a bit by cybersecurity analysts. We have a transform server for that that ties into the database. And overall, we have over 300 million records now. And what's coming soon, and part of the reason that I want to give you this update at this time, is that we try to work an attribution. So not just, you know, is this domain bad? Like, who's actually behind that? Who's the real person? Then it goes to law enforcement and take a business forever. The part of that, though, is knowing something more about the address. Is it a real address? Is it fake, et cetera? Because in cybersecurity, you're using the same information that a lot of people in the domain industry use, and it's who is, et cetera, et cetera. The bad guys tend to use the same garbage information over and over again, though. Very interesting. So you can actually track them that way and correlate them. But we have been working with Canada Post. Oh, I'll get into that in a second. I'm jumping the gun here. We have a postal address validation system that's free to use. We are going to be working on a phone number validation to follow that, and the browser fingerprint, which I talked about, and also registrar rankings. And I'll get into each of these. I'm watching the time.
Don't worry.
Okay. Postal address validation. In partnership with Canada Post, as I mentioned, we're both Canadians. Just turns out they've been developing a system for the last 8 years on address validation. Obviously, within Canada, they have a very good handle on it, even to the point where they know that they've actually delivered a piece of mail to that address. So they know it exists because someone's actually gone there and did something. They also have fuzzy logic that's put in. So, like, I live on Greeley, or I live on Bush Drive. If I put in Bush Road, it would still find it. It wouldn't matter. And I live in a town called Greeley, which is kind of part of Ottawa. If I put in Ottawa, they'll still find me. So it has that fuzzy logic built in. They partner with somebody else on international address validation. We found that that's not up to the snuff that we want to be. So we're now looking into actually Google Maps API, getting a business license for that so we can do high volume transactions on that. And everyone knows that Google knows everything about everything in the world. So we're in the early stages of adding that into the address validation as well. And this is free. It's free to anybody who's a member. Oh, I want to mention the U.S., oddly, Canada Post does not have a good handle on address validation in the U.S. I forget why. There's some silly reason for it. But UPS, they have a system for validating addresses where they're going to ship in the U.S., and they said we could use it. So all that was just passed through. Someone wants to validate an address, we'll just pass it through to these partners, and you get a score back. It's free. We're looking for beta testers for this, by the way. If anyone wants to speak up, I already talked to our friends in Prague. Phone number validation. Right now, we just do a simple regular expression check on the phone number. Is it a valid phone number, for instance? If it's in country code 1, which is actually about 14 countries, I think it's Canada, US, and a bunch of the Caribbean islands. Compromises country code 1, but make sure the area codes exist. And 1.7 did not exist; they're garbage. That's a very, very simple test. I'll publish the findings on those soon. We have been talking to some other companies about actually doing some phone number validations, something a bit more hefty. We haven't found anything yet that is cost effective. It's a very costly venture.
Do you do any address verification? Sorry.
Excuse the interruption. I was just wondering if you do address validation as well. My name's Jason Schultz. Sorry.
Yeah, you mean in comparison, in connection with the phone?
Yeah.
Not combined. Yeah, not combined yet. So, yes. So, the answer is no. But yes, you are correct. We don't do that. Okay, the browser fingerprints. We had a browser fingerprint algorithm we're using. It was about 94% good. We've turfed that. Sorry, we actually threw them all away. So we started over, and we have a much better one now. And the algorithm actually is reversible. So that, let's say that someone updated Java in the browser, you could actually see that that's the only part that changed within the browser, which is, it's kind of a cool algorithm. Now that code's available if anyone wants to use it. Registrar ranking. This is something we intend to do. We actually run every day. We look at a breakdown for actually all the registries on bad names that were identified. Those reports are available to anyone. Just ask for it. You can have, well, as long as you are the registry, you can have it. So my address is at the front of the presentation. Just send me an email and we'll get that set up. What we're looking for the ranking, though, for the registrars is not how many bad domains they have, but how responsive they are to abuse complaints, because you actually want them to improve, right? So we have to develop the algorithm for that, but it will actually be based on turnaround times and have they actually responded to an abuse complaint rather than just how many domains are there. Through that, what we expect to happen is that the registrars who basically don't care will probably rise to the top of that list. So, a little synopsis of the API. There's we have validation scoring for postal address, phone, email. We have malicious ranking on the email address, IP address, domain, also the address, phone number, and fingerprint. The reply back is actually be very simple, or like JSON, or you can go with XML. Kind of get your choice on what you want. If you put in little plus details, you'll get all the details, and it looks like that, and you probably can't see that at all on the screen. But it'll give you a sense of what's there for this. This is actually it's querying on an email address, saying that it's malware. That was associated with a botnet. That same email has been seen in the forums stealing for stolen credit cards. And then it's just a generic abuse as well. Then it has some more information on data is associated with this. I think there's also a browser fingerprint in there. So, summary of this is that if you're interested in address validation, it's free to registries, registrars, and hosting companies. Just contact us, away you go. If you're interested in participating on the abuse, either getting data or helping us and provide data to share with your counterparts, come talk to us. And let us know if there's something else that's not here that you need to make this useful for you. And I think that's it.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? We are a bit ahead of time, so please feel free to ask. Yes, Jason.
This is Jason Schultz. I'm just looking at the website and looking at the registrar rankings. It says coming soon.
Yeah.
So maybe can you give us a sense of who are some of the worst registrars that you found so far? S domains or... well, I have experience with a few that I think are pretty shady.
So. I think for people that are doing any type of cybersecurity, you tend to know which ones there are. There's three or four, right? But there is no hard evidence right now against them. I think that, if we actually start, sending them abuse complaints, they're non-responsive, then, that's going to become more evident. We'll actually have some type of metric. Because one of the problems, we talked to ICANN. We spent a day at ICANN, talked to all the various departments. And then the compliance side, they need help as well, right? The ICANN's very tied with all their handcuffs, with all their contracts and everything. They got to watch about getting sued because they got a whack of money sitting there. And, you know, people want to sue that and get that and their hands around that. But, you know, we can help them. Yeah. So. Well, thank you.
No questions? All right. Good. Thank you. There is one from the remote.
There is one person called Adebumi Akimbo who says he would like to get the abuse report. And but it's not really a question. And Chris Davis is
responding.
okay,
perfect.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
That's great. That's good.
Okay. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me just see who the next one is. Daniel Kaltchev will now speak about the REC-AA protocol. Afterwards is Oscar Romero about .co.
Okay, so this is a presentation for protocol that we have been developing. The reason we decided to develop our own protocol is, I would say, mainly because we first had the registration procedure, then the registration system, and then finally came to the conclusion that we cannot do without a protocol. We looked at what was available as, let's say, various ideas and implementations. We did not find any of those compatible with our system and registration process. So we decided to implement our own protocol. So I will try to share some of the concepts and actually try to keep the presentation not specific to our implementation, but to what the protocol can actually solve, in the hope that it may be useful for others too. So the protocol is, I would say, yet another XML protocol. The key thing that is probably differentiating this protocol is that all the messages that are exchanged over the protocol are individually signed. The messages are supposed to be exchanged over an encrypted channel, but this is, of course, not a requirement. And every message that is exchanged from the, let's say, the inner message and all the encapsulating messages here is all the authentication data that may be necessary for the registry or whoever is processing the message to authorize various object creation or manipulation. Another interesting aspect of the protocol is that with every message, the version of the nomenclatures, that is the lists of various possible values, is communicated. And if there is a difference between the server and the client can request an update of these lists so that they have up-to-date information. This is one feature that is, I would say, directly related to the verification of the data that is stored at the registry database, because the server is supposed to refuse any data that does not conform to the published nomenclature lists. And also, the messages can be nested in many levels that allows more than two levels of communication that we commonly see in our implementation. So what is the, let's say, goals that we achieve with this protocol? One is that we want to have a secure communication channel with registrars. So with the registrars, we have contracts. We know who they are. And therefore know how they will present themselves, okay, identify themselves to the registry. Another goal is to have secure communication with registrant. This is, I would say, the most common problem all registry have. And the problem mostly boils down to the situation that almost no registry knows who the actual registrant is. They all get this information through some kind of proxy and with not strong enough authentication. So the idea of this protocol is that if we can identify the registrant, we can have communication with that registrant with the confidence that they are the party that requests the object additions or modifications, even if they go through a proxy like the registrar. Of course, the protocol achieves end-to-end encryption and signing of all messages. In the case of our implementation, we keep record of every message that was ever exchanged with the registry, so that in the case of any disputes, we can produce those messages. Another very important issue that the protocol solves is the separate authentication and authorization of the registrars and the registrants. In the most common model, the registrant will authorize the registrar to do anything on their behalf. This is often not the case in real life, and is, I would say, probably the key reason why we had to develop a protocol like this. So in essence, the authorization of the protocol messages will follow the construction relationships between the different parties. And here I would like to just say that the registry users are ultimately the registrants, and the registry should have a means to fulfill their contractual obligations to the registrants, even if the registrar is not functioning properly. So, in short, how the protocol works, this is more or less related to the current implementation. We expect that the registrant will prepare and sign the message they want delivered to the registry. They could do that either through some interface that the registrar will provide, or they may use some other kind of protocol or the same protocol to send a message to the registrar. Then the registrar would encapsulate that registrant message in their own message and will communicate that message to the registry. This is the role of a proxy that we often expect from the registrar. Then when the registry will receive the message, it will, of course, check all the integrity of all the layers by verifying the signatures at every level. And according to the signatures that are used for each message, it could authorize the party to do the different, parts of the requests it intends, like adding new domains or some modifications, object removal, and so on. And of course, if the registrant does not want to deal with any of this, they could authorize the registrar to submit messages on their behalf. So in this case, we fall back to a scheme that we have now. We will trust the registrar to do the object modification on behalf of the registrant. And then the last mode is that since we already know who the registrant is and can authenticate them securely, we can let them communicate directly with the registry so that they can, for example, automate the management of their DNS and DNSSEC data, or contact data updates and similar with the registry without the need of the registrar to participate in this case. So, the implementation, we had this problem protocol completed 2 years ago. As of now, three of the registrars that we have for .bg already use the protocol to communicate with the registry. We have also implemented several proxies that use the protocol and provide a subset of the commands for those registrars that have not yet implemented it. The current server implementation expects to run over TCP/IP with TLS. This is not a strict requirement because, like I said, the protocol is stateless. It can use 7 datagram transport. And the only, I would say, the negative thing we have so far in the implementation is that we are not yet ready with full translation of the documentation in English. So that was my presentation, more or less.
Okay, thank you very much. I have one question. I personally, as a registry, don't want to communicate with my registrants. Why would you want to do that?
Well, if you ask the registry as a business, of course we would not want to do that. We will prefer to do less work and get more pay. But the reality is that we ultimately have a contract with the registrars, not only with the registrars. This may be, in some cases, for historical reasons, but it's a fact. And we get a lot of questions from registrants to implement, let's say, more direct communication. Then there is another issue is that we often see a situation when the registry wants to implement new technologies, like, for example, DNSSEC is very good example in this situation, where most of the registrars simply don't care. And there is no other way to make them care than to let everybody else be able to handle that tasks. So this will actually, and as we see from the examples in real life, let's say, motivate the registrars to move faster.
Okay, my policy of our registry is totally opposed. We do not communicate with individual applicants unless there is gross misconduct of a registrar. We have a help desk, and we have the most favored replies. We don't talk to individual registrants. Please go to your registrar. I'm just saying, different models. The less you have to talk to thousands of individual clients, the less help desk staff you have to employ and things like this. For a small registry, we have no employees. So I have to do the help desk. I don't really want to talk to 3,500 applicants.
So this is why we implemented a protocol.
Yes, but
we don't really want to involve people into this.
Sure, but that implies that people, that registrants, understand the how protocol is written. Our people don't really know how email works. My internet is not working. Okay, doesn't matter what. So it's different philosophy. We feel, and I think many registry feels, as little communication with the individual applicants so that we can cut down on the help desk. CZNIC has got a help desk of a few people. They deal with individual applicants. You have got, we as a small, very small operation, we just don't want to. If we wanted to or if we had to, of course, that's one way of doing it. Yeah, so I'm not trying to criticize the implementation. I'm just trying to sort of ask from behind, why would one want to do that? Warren was first, and you will be next. We are good for time, and we have to have a few minutes break for technical reasons, because we must sort of get the translators who have in the meantime arrived, so that we can get them onto the system.
Warren Kamari, Google. Quick question. Wouldn't it have been simpler to have just used an extension to EPP or something like that?
An extension to EPP would mean that we replaced the, let's say, normal EPP with Cygnet XML EPP. And it will again create a completely different protocol. Because the idea we had, and the need actually we had, is to be able to authenticate the sender of the message, not the postman who delivered the message to us.
Oh yes, Jason, I forgot.
This is Jason Schultz. I just want to clarify one thing. So this protocol is meant to be between the registry and the registrars?
Yes.
Only?
No. Not only.
And the individual domain registrants as well?
Yes.
So recently there's been a string of attacks, for example, by the Syrian Electronic Army, where they basically steal someone's credentials and they go in and they alter name servers and things like that. Yeah. How does this, you know, someone could just as easily steal a certificate?
Yes and no. I mean, okay, in this case, this is yet another point here. I actually left it out of the presentation on purpose, because I was sure that I actually had a slide that was labeled "Why not TPP?" But the point here is that if they steal the certificate of the registrar, what has happened in most cases, nothing will happen in our protocol. We will get an outer message, the stamp of the, let's say, postal service forged, but we will still either have a valid internal message signed by the registrant, or we will have something that we don't recognize and we simply don't care. And then the best part of it is we will have good evidence of what we actually received, because it will all have digital signatures on it. So that's not bad.
Thank you.
And just one more point. Of course, if they wanted to, for example, forge the size of Google, like what happened in many of those cases, they should have gotten the certificate that Google used to send the messages. And if they can do that, they can hack their sites too. So that's fine.
We've got Google here. Let's talk them.
So Warren Kamari, Google again. So I deal with a number of the DNS hijacks that we get. And in the large majority of the cases, it's not actually that the credentials have been stolen or guessed or anything like that. In the what seems to be the majority of the cases, often it's hard to get actual details, but it seems to be that it's actually the registry itself that's been owned through either SQL injection attacks, which are unfortunately still really common. or just web parameter changes. So, you know, the URL will be whatever the either the registrar or the registry /user=7 domain equals something. And then somebody will just change the domain parameter to be, you know, google.whatever. That is still, you know, a really old attack, but it still works on a lot of places. Oh, God, yes. Probably upwards of 75% are a combination of SQL and the other.
Anything else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next presentation will be .co. And then we'll take, I would think we take a 5 to 10 minute break after the presentation. We are a little bit ahead, not much though, so that we can connect the translators to the outside thing.
Hi, everybody. I am Gonzalo Romero. I am the Chief Security Officer of the .co Internet. We are currently the registry of the Colombian CCTLD. I am very glad and proud to be here for showing you our strategy in the CCTLD in regard to the security issues. I have these 8 items in the agenda. It's very, very short, so I would like to show you the motivation we have, the security policies we are currently handling, our knowledge transfer and cooperation actions efforts, the malicious activities monitoring process we have in place for 3 years, our current challenge in cybersecurity, and at the end, you can ask me whatever you need. Okay, I think you know that we are a private company, and we have a concession contract with the government of Colombia, and we work on the promotion and engagement of the community in terms of a global perspective, not only the in-country perspective. So we are working more on the spread of the community worldwide. And we have a very nice responsibility with our registrants worldwide. We are working on this because we feel that we are responsible in the short term of these kind of things. And as administrator of the CCTLD, we are very committed to protect the integrity, the stability, and reliability of the IT and the services of the TLD, and as well of the image and reputation of worldwide. And we think that security is an added value for the registrants worldwide, and we participate and contribute with efforts, activities, and initiatives to maintain the SSR of the Internet global ecosystem. This slide shows you the security policies we have in place. One of the first, I think, it's a very successful point is our price. We are not cheap, and it's a deterrent of malicious or abusive illegal domain name registrations, and that's very good for us in terms of, you know, we are not a $5 per year domain. We have a very good practices on IT security and business continuity. We have a very, very strong and relationship with Neustar, our partner in this kind of things. We have a very interesting an innovative malicious activities monitoring MAM process. that has a security position and a reputation of the CCTLD globally. We have a very, very strong relationship with our registrars in terms of conditions that what we are working on the process of suspend domains or notify registrants and registrars in terms of malicious activity. And we have a lot of work in terms of global, regional, and in-country initiatives for working together in terms of security. And all the time we are working on knowledge transfer and security awareness, and working on joint efforts for awareness campaigns and initiatives for work to work with private and public entities, not only inside our country, but regionally and globally as well. Okay, in terms of knowledge transfer and cooperation action, I think that's the key of our success in terms of security. Is we are all time building community in terms of security as well. We have a core DNS community in which you can participate as well. We have a DNSSEC technology and security day every year in August. And we have a very interesting active participation and commitment with a national, regional, and global community. We support every initiative, for example, to certify national certs in the first organization. We currently have now 5 certified certs in our country. So that's very good initiative and process. We are very close to have the, our national cert certified by first, so that's a good news. And we have a lot of agreements internally with law enforcement agencies, with the certs all time, and IXP, and we have a very strong relationship as well with the academic community, and among other agreements with them. And globally, we participate with, we are members of the Anti-Phishing Working Group, and we have a very interesting agreements with Microsoft and NCMEC. We participate on DNS.org. We have a very strong relationship with RSA and other very high-level companies in security, so that's a very good point for strengthening our security in the TLD. This slide shows you the malicious activities monitoring we have. It's a non-intrusive process of just monitoring the zone, looking for malicious URLs or domain names. The feeds are provided for several trusted third parties. We validate phishing, farming, malware distribution, malicious hacking, defacement, and child porn cases. The Newstar CERT is our investigation body. They take the potential alerts and notify to the registrars and eventually to the registrants as well. And work with registrars and registrants given a timeline from 6 to 24 hours to resolve or risk to put the domain in server hold or to extract from the DNS zone. And all of our work in terms of this kind of security issues is based on corporate action and terms and conditions. We have a very interesting and strong agreement with the registrars, and they have a transitive agreement with the registrants, so that we ask for them to notify the registrant at the end to solve the problem we are notifying. In terms of special cases like rogue pharma, content piracy, or spam, we forward that cases to the Colombian law enforcement agencies. We have a cooperation agreement for research and actions. And this, our challenges, I think the most important and relevant we have now is the cyber squatting. It's a very difficult and challenging process. And obviously, the any infringement or violation to our terms and conditions. We have a very proactive monitoring of hourly.co domain name registration, looking for trademark and intellectual property violations, and that's very important. And this is the letter we sent to the suspicious registrants doing some kind of cyber squatting or type of squatting in our domain. We proactively are doing this kind of thing, of efforts just to not allowing this kind of issues in the domain. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? How many domain names did you have?
We have 600,000 domains currently.
And what did you say your price was?
$30 per domain per year.
How much?
$30.
$30.
Yes. That's the mean.
It's very cheap. In Namibia, we have a premium domain model. We have even less fraudulent registrations than you have. They just can't afford it. It's just not worth the effort. Any other questions? I think we'll break for about 5 to 10 minutes. We don't have to go. It's just I need to do some technical stuff so that the translators come on. Can you indicate when you're ready for us? Okay, thank you.
Yeah.